Welcome to the Inside the Post-Dispatch podcast, the podcast that brings you inside the Post-Dispatch newsroom. I'm David Hunt, a reporter at the Post-Dispatch. I'm here today with St. Louis County reporter Jeremy Kohler. And our guest is Dave Leipoltz, a director at merger advocacy group Better Together. Dave led research and staffing efforts for the group's 160-page report, which came out about 3 weeks ago now. And it advocates for a complete consolidation of St. Louis City, St. Louis County, and all 88 municipalities. That probably is not quite fine a point enough for Dave, but we can talk more about it as we go here. Dave, why don't you just real quick start us out with some biographical information about yourself, since that's all anybody cares about in this thing is where everybody's from and what they do, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, you do. It's interesting. Some of the conversations we have, we have what we call the St. Louis apology, which is this lady originated this by saying, you know, I've only lived in St. Louis 20 years, but I really think that we should. And, you know, it's definitely there's like some credibility, I guess you earn that way. But I'm a lifelong St. Louisan. Came to Better Together when we started in 2013, leading the research efforts.
And you grew up in South City.
Correct.
Grew up hardcore Blues and Cardinals fan.
Correct.
And then did you go away for college? Did you stay here?
I stayed here for WashU for undergrad and then SLU for law school.
And then from there you went to one of the big business associations, right?
I was at the Regional Business Council managing public policy there.
Okay. And then ended up at Better Together. And you essentially are like the arm. So there was a task force you all put together, and that task force led kind of the philosophical drive of how to, you know, how this consolidation was going to happen. But you led the practical part of it.
Yeah, the task force was, there's, I think we all know a couple different kinds of task force that exist, you know, some in name and some in practice. And they were, you know, people I talked to, quite frankly, more than family members. And so they were very involved. But we did the research and provided the information they needed to make these decisions and recommendations on a day-to-day basis.
All right. Let me start with something that is just an easy opener. And that is, I can only imagine that you've had a ton of comments and feedback over these past 3 weeks.
Yes.
Tell us the ones, like, what stands out is the stuff that is, you know, the biggest assumptions that people are making that are wrong. Like, if you wanted to just clear the air on, like, two or three points, what would you clear the air on?
Yeah, I think a few, a lot of the concerns, and the way that most people come to this is through their day-to-day life. You know, what their services are going to be impacted. Is this a bailout of the city? That's a big one, which we put in place a structure that makes sure that debt stays with the people who incur it.
And we will get to that point in depth.
Correct.
All right.
And we also created a structure that provides local government entities through these municipal districts and that sense of community and around those super local services people wanted very close to them, but at the same time allows St. Louis to do the big regional things, economic development, public safety together.
So you said that one of the big assumptions folks are making is that this is a city debt bailout.
Correct.
Can we just jump in there, Jeremy? Is that a good starting spot for the more detailed questions?
Yeah.
Okay. So it is confusing. When you read the report, on one hand it says, frankly, the county's not going to bail out the city debt, that the city debt's going to stay with the city's going to become this metropolitan district, and the county's, you know, not going to bail it out. But on the other hand, there is language in there that says that the new metro city can assume all debts from anybody. So how do we justify those, and how do we know what, like, kind of the true intentions are, so to speak?
Yeah, why put it in there if it's not something you're planning to do?
Because we always go back to the reason that we're in this situation in the first place is at some point a bunch of leaders in St. Louis and in the state of Missouri decided they had all the answers and that they were going to embody that in the Constitution, these divides, these answers. What we provided was opportunities for this government to decide based on, you know, the representation of the entire region to do. What we're saying is that to the extent that debt has been incurred not just by the city but by other municipal districts, that it stays with them, as do the funding streams. Now, if as a region the metro city decided to do something differently, we think they should have the authority to respond to what constituents and what citizens want. And so at any point where we could give authority to the Metro Mayor, the Metro Council moving forward, we did that with the idea that we don't know in 10, 20, 30, 40 years what the answers to some things are going to be. And maybe a lot of those debts get completely paid down and they, you know, decide to do a big bond issue. They just roll them. There's all these different options that other regions have done. We left those options there, but those things don't happen unless you have a regional vote on that.
Let's stay on this for a quick second. So what I hear you saying is we are not ordering the debt to be covered by the Metro City. In fact, we're structuring it so that it won't be covered by the Metro City. However, we are giving the leaders the opportunity to take over that debt if they so choose.
I think that we are leaving that authority with them so that, you know, let's say there's some value to rolling up all the municipal debt in general for the region. You know, these are all options they have, and we wanted to leave every door open. But yes, we structured it, and the function that's recommended is for debt to stay and be paid off by the people who incurred it. And I really think that that's the road where it's going to go by or go through, because there's really complex system of debt. There's a complex system of funding and paying for that debt too that's already been in place that's being relied upon to pay that debt and provide that stability. And so I think keeping that there is the smartest way to go.
But individually, I mean, the reason why these places have debt is because they didn't have the cash up front for whatever they were purchasing. So are they going to have the revenue sources to pay down that debt suddenly, or are they going to continue? I mean, the city of St. Louis has been in a deficit for years, so how are they suddenly going to have a surplus where they can pay that down?
Right. I think that one of the things that we ensured is if there's a dedicated funding stream that stays, but if you're talking about like GR and, you know, general revenue, things like that, that you'll need for it. Our concern actually in looking at the numbers, which we'll roll out in a couple weeks, is actually more so that we'll have too much money at the front end. We'll just grow to spend it and not do it as intelligently as we should over time. So I think that from our standpoint, we're confident that debt can be paid down. There's not a concern there. We left all the options there because we did that for everything. But I think that in terms of is there going to be enough revenue, that is assured in just the same way it is today because we're keeping those same funding streams. So you're not eliminating any chances or increasing any chances based on what we're doing. It's because it's still reliant on those funding streams. And in the background of this, you have an efficiency of government that's taking place over time, too.
Dave, that's another good spot to just keep going on this topic. So there's a bunch of tax cuts that are outlined in the report. There's the earnings tax goes away. Gosh, I'm going to screw this up, Dave. Over 10 years?
Yes, it's statutory phase out.
Right. And then the payroll tax goes away also over 10 years?
I believe that's over 20.
Over 20. Okay. I don't remember exactly which. And then the property tax.
Mm-hmm.
And explain to us the property tax. That's a little more complicated. It's different for the city and the county.
Yes. So we get this question a lot. So just to clarify for folks, a lot of people in the county, for example, think they have a property tax bill. But within that, there's a kind of baseline property tax from the county. There's a property tax for your municipality if you live in one. There's a property tax for your school district. And so what was lessened was the property tax at that very baseline level for the metro region. And it's based on about half the rate of the current county taxes.
Back up a step. What's lessened and for who?
So for the whole of the region, your baseline property tax rate, not the one you pay for your municipality, not the one you pay for your school district, but the one that you pay for if you're, you know, living in the region at all, you either pay through the county or the city, that is going to be lessened.
For everybody, the county and the city?
Yes. Yeah, so what will happen is it's a lesson for everybody. Now, so everybody should see from that standpoint a decrease. One of the things that happens in the city is that there's also a fire protection district. So that will get some funding from the property tax as well, but we don't see that exceeding the current tax rate for the city. So everybody should see some at least modest decrease in that.
So in the county, the property tax rate will go down. In the city, it might stay the same because of the fire protection district?
It should show an initial dip. And just to get to the, you know, I think the question behind that is why cut it? We have skyrocketing high sales tax in this region. And so until that comes down and you can kind of start equalizing taxes and get to a healthier scheme where we don't have 30% sales tax rates in this region, which if you talk to people in other regions, they're like, that is insane because they don't even do local sales tax in Kentucky and Indiana. And so it's an incentive to say we have to rectify those things over time.
Where does the savings come in? How do you cut taxes? What aren't you going to be spending money on?
Sure. So I think when we're looking at other regions, we are looking at essentially right-sizing government. Now, I think during the transition, you're going to need the staff that you have. And I think that's why, you know, you hear the mayor and county executive saying no one's losing their job. I think that's not only a promise, it has to be true, because if you look at a transition, you're doing two things. You're not just doing your job today, but you're also working to consolidate these governments. And so, but then over time, if you look at some of the attrition rates, and, you know, I'm the first one to kind of be skeptical when people start talking about that, but government staffs, especially local government staffs, are much older in workforce than others. So, you know, in the city of St. Louis, you have an attrition rate of like 400 a year. And so when you multiply that over just 2 years, that's, you know, you're getting close to $50 and $60 million less in payroll that we think that people won't have to be fired. But those jobs through efficiency and consolidation also don't have to be rehired. And so, I mean, that's a really big number right there. And so, and the cuts, really, like the big cuts around earnings tax, those are all phased. And so I think it's done in a really deliberate, healthy way to not say we have to make these decisions right now because we're not going to have the revenue. It's a way that says we can do this over time at the right time for this new metro government.
Jeremy had a great question earlier. So you've got all these people, you know, coming together, all these, you know, county folks and city folks who are now suddenly going to be in one department, one building, whatever, right? And walk us through how that's going to work. I mean, I've read the report and I see a lot of the changes, but it just sounds crazy. So you're going to have some people like, yeah, two fire chiefs. You know, how do you put the fire chiefs together? Are they still both chiefs? Do they get paid the same? Do they get paid different? Like, yeah. How's this going to work?
Well, we're not doing fire, so I just want to.
Sorry, right.
Clarify.
Forgive me. health
yeah,
department.
I mean, you've got a policeman in Hillsdale who's making $40,000.
Right.
One in the city who's making $55,000. One in this county who's making $75,000. One in Chesterfield is making $95,000.
Yeah.
They're all in one department now with the same.
Yeah.
What do they get paid?
You know, to your point, that's like the insanity of the situation and like how fragmentation plays out makes the transition even harder because there are those big differences. And so they come in making what they're making with the seniority and service. All pensions are honored. That was one of the things, you know, we did our tweaks this week. One of the things we wanted to really reinforce with folks and be as crystal clear as possible with those clarifications is because people have been banking on those for 10, 20 years of their life. Those don't go away. Service doesn't go away. So making that clear. When it comes to bringing those folks under a police department, we try to do things as practically as possible. And that's why 2 years is a little longer than some places have done it. But governments are not ever built with, you know, what if we want to, like, put these together later? And so it'll be tough. It'll be a slog. But we brought them in as is, so no one will come in and make less right away. But then we have a chief during the transition that gets appointed. He has command control over all the departments as they are today. And we have folks that are in that profession consolidating and creating the salary matrix and, you know, rectifying rank and all that. So, and that's true of all these departments because, and David, to your point, one of the things that's like really challenging is you have these departments that have maybe even the same name, but they do two totally different things. So it's gonna require the institutional knowledge of both to do it.
So, all right, sorry. Clarify this point that you just made. So you have two police officers. They both are the same rank, the same experience. One's making 45. One's making 75. The report or the amendment says they have to both come in at their same rank and pay.
Right.
So does that mean that just for a little while, for a year, for 2 years, for whatever, they will indeed make 45 and 75, even though they're doing the same job?
Yes, and for a couple of reasons. I think that's the fairest way to start it because they're essentially continuing on. And a lot of times, you know, I think people visualize a guy making 75 and a guy making 45 getting put in the same car together. But during that transition is when those different matrix for salary and scales and all those things will be rectified and worked out by people who know how to do that best. But also those officers making 45 are still probably going to be working in the same place in the same department, and the ones making 75 the same. And so there's nothing unawkward about the transition in virtually every aspect. It is going to be a massive undertaking that's not only going to take government, but outside resources and guidance, and because governments just aren't built to do this.
Dave, so are the police officers associations, are they on board with this?
You know, I think we've had good conversations with the officers, you know, whether they'll formally support or I think that we went about this in a way that hopes to garner the support of the workers that are going through this, because we really, and it was really important to the task force that St. Louis, especially, everybody knows people like these are our neighbors, our friends, and they've been working in these systems for years, was to make sure that they were not any worse off being in this. And so I think that we will win over officers, some of those workers, and so I hope so, but I haven't heard anything.
What did
about
you tell them when you talked to them? Did you say, hey, your 75,000 officer eventually might have to take a haircut? Or, I mean, that's going to be a question they want to know more than anything, right? How do you answer that for them?
Beyond the transition years.
Yeah.
You know, 5 years out.
You know, I think that we, the task force recommendations are, especially if you want to stay on the topic of public safety, not something in the recommendations is to slash budgets for public safety and officers. And I think that in a well-resourced department, our biggest obstacle is going to be having enough officers for that department and high quality training people in those positions. So our conversations with them were the same as they were with workers in other departments, which is really, here's what's happening, here's the benefits we see, here's the benefits for you potentially. You know, ask us your hard questions. And when it comes to what am I going to make in 5 years, you just have to be honest and say, you know, that is going to be part of the collective bargaining, part of all these things that you go through now. And so I think we really try to not make promises we couldn't keep and to make those conversations harder. But at the end of the day, I also think that's how you build trust, when you're willing to be honest and have those tough conversations and not make promises you can't follow through on.
So you all have said that right now what you're seeing across the community is younger folks tend to support this and older folks tend less likely to be supportive. Are you seeing the same in the officers? Because I could see that dynamic, right? You've got a kid coming in who's making 45, who sees potential in a big department to mm-hmm. grow. You got a guy who's been there for 30 years who's making 75, who thinks, geez, this could end up with me making significantly less.
Right. Yeah, I to a certain degree, I think in the larger populace, it's a little bit more, there needs to be some education done. And those numbers can move. But I think, yeah, across the board, whether you're police or your average citizen, you hit the nail on the head. If you're 45 and under, Democrat, Republican, black, white, city, county, you're probably for this. But there is, I think, an increased apprehension because they're further down the road in how they planned their life. And so really the pension question was a big one. And we were able to...
pension, yeah, that's a huge point.
Yeah, and so to give them the assurances, you know, we researched as well as we could, how do you do these things that you don't shake up people's life plans? Because for a lot of these officers, they don't get paid as much because they don't have to, you know, they have the pension on the back end. And so I think addressing those concerns really got us into a good place and good conversations. But yeah, the concerns are definitely different based on age.
But the pensions too, those same situation, right, where the new Metro City doesn't immediately take on those pension obligations, but it could down the road.
So what will happen with pensions is that, like other debt, the outstanding obligation until the Metro City takes over is something that stays with the entity that incurred it. And then the new Metro would become responsible for funding pensions moving forward. And so that was...
Do they stay pensions or do they transition into like 401ks or something?
So the way, if it was, you know, the Metro City could determine new hires, they could do it that way. But folks come in with their current pension and they could stay with their old one and the Metro City could just pay into that. But the Metro City could start new pensions moving forward. So we tried to give them flexibility outside of the folks who are already, you know, in these systems vested, things like that. Because I think that most people would agree that we need some reform around pension, but that needs to happen down the road and not with people who, you know, where promises were already made.
But this is an opportunity for that kind of reform then.
Correct.
Because you're starting over. Mm-hmm. So you could restart pensions.
the public reaction to this in the St. Louis area has been really negative. I mean, it's been the, you know, every municipality is against it. And I know there are some people that are for it, but you have a lot of organization against it. Is there a compromise somewhere in here that maybe this isn't, you know, maybe you don't get 100% of what's in the amendment, but there's something that you can get that people would agree to?
I think there's a couple questions in there. One thing, I think that from elected officials, the public, there's a unified and organized effort through the Municipal League to say, we don't like these things. It's been a lot of the same people since the very beginning. So I think that those people have had a platform in the past few weeks. But I can tell you, I'm not surprised in any way by any of the opposition. And I think that we would say that our proponents are in, I mean, we had 110 requests for meetings in the past week and a half to go do speaking engagements. And we have not just our team, but Speakers Bureau, business leader, people going to do these. And we have the 8 town halls that are filling up. Will some of those be people that are against? I'm sure. But I also think that this is really big, and it's kind of jarring almost for people who live their lives, go to work. And so we know we need these 2 years to do that education. You know, I'm not contradicting and saying it was, you know, puppies and rainbows for the past 2 weeks, but I think that, you know, there's a real opportunity for education there. In terms of the compromise, you know, contrary to the Municipal League's narrative, is they're offered a seat on our board. We try to engage with them. We put them on our working groups. But the compromise there is between a group that wants to do something transformational and a group that doesn't really seem to want to do much of anything. I mean, we've been around for 5 years, and now they got together and 88 leaders in the community decided we're going to spend another year or two doing a process. They don't even recommend on anything. And so, you know, it's hard to compromise on that, because my experience with the organized opposition has been what they want is to control the process and limit it as much as possible. And I don't know, and that's their agenda, and that's fine, but I think they should be honest about that, and we're being honest about ours. And so I don't know. I will say that our recommendations provide a framework, and that the policy and systems that need to be implemented, because we have had to do a statewide vote, we wanted those things to be implemented through a local council and local decisions as much as possible. So I think there's a ton of work and compromise and logistics, and really just as important as this initial effort is those policies and structures we put in place. And so I think along those lines, I hope that there's conversations, and I hope it's amongst people who come from different ideas but can sit down together. I mean, I think that's, we've been trying to do that.
Have you done any polling yet to see how this would fly in the area or in the state?
You know, we did some initial polling, surveying months ago. Just really what we were looking at was, one of the things when you're doing a big project like this is you don't want to find out you were in a bubble on one of the decisions and something just, you know, people don't want to consolidate public health or police is a deal breaker. But what we got back was the feedback that we had essentially gotten from community meetings, which is there's an appetite for this in this region. I think that folks that say, you know, this is statewide because the city and county won't support it, I disagree with that. I think that, you know, in these initial weeks and probably months, there's going to be an intensity that makes it hard to imagine that it passes in St. Louis City and County. But I think, you know, and to, David, to your original point, this is what we've seen in other regions, is a younger generation convinces their parents, because this is the place they want to live, raise their kids and grandkids, that this is what they need. We need to be growing and thriving. And so I think there's a lot of momentum there. And we saw, you know, one of the interesting items, and this was several months ago, I don't remember the exact numbers, but the number one feedback and recommendation from St. Louis City and County, and that's weighted appropriately for population, was, I think, for 34%, was to just eliminate everything and have one big government altogether. But that didn't really jive with our community feedback, which said, we want to do the big things together, but we want to do the local things local. And so we try to do both.
Dave, let me get one more question in, and then I think we got to wrap up. Explain to readers or listeners who don't know, why do you have to go statewide?
Sure.
Give us the two-sentence version.
So there's a lot of push for a Board of Freeholders process, which, you know, is essentially the mayor and county executive appointing people. You have a local vote, but those recommendations don't really amend the Constitution. They provide a way through the Constitution for the city and county to come together. But it was contemplated at a time where there weren't 88 municipalities, 55 police departments, and 81 courts. And so what they don't do is allow you to consolidate those police departments, because the Board of Freeholders recommendation is still subject to general Missouri law and constitutional of Missouri. And so a general Missouri law says that if you're a city of over 400 people, you have a police department, you provide police service. So we couldn't do police reform. The municipal courts especially are in the state court system, which is in the Constitution. And we have a lot of charter cities in St. Louis County that weren't really contemplated at the time this was put in there, and they get their authority from the Constitution of Missouri. And so there's all these obstacles to getting to the big transformative changes the task force wanted to implement.
Dave, I've got like 8 million more questions for you. I'm sure Jeremy does too. But thank you so much for spending this time with us. Next week, we will interview the Municipal League.
I look forward to you asking them about their plan.
All right. Again, this is David Hahn, a reporter at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, with Jeremy Kohler, who covers St. Louis County for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and Dave Leipoltz, director at Better Together. Thank you so much, Dave, for coming.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Inside the Post-Dispatch podcast. You can find more episodes as well as other Post-Dispatch podcasts on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you can listen to podcasts. Or at stltoday.com/podcasts. You can continue to support the journalism we're doing at the Post-Dispatch by going to stltoday.com/subscribe. Digital subscriptions start at just 99 cents for the first month, eliminating the pop-ups and surveys. And that's, again, stltoday.com/subscribe.